You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. According to an internet news story this week, veteran BBC war correspondent Kate Ady revealed on an Irish radio station that the Pentagon had threatened to fire on the satellite uplink positions of independent journalists in Iraq. KPFK's Sonali Kolhatar spoke with Rachel Cohen, a media analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and Kate Ady.
Time and again, it has been pressed these days to the military that modern journalists are going to be using satellite uplinks, both for satellite telephones and also to send copy and photographs and also television pictures. And it has been argued back, and it is no secret that these links, first of all, constitute a problem when used on the home side, in other words, amongst one's allies, because the argument is that they identify positions. And there is much talk about restricting the use of these, especially with embedded journalists. When I turn to the point of what about targeting about uplinks that come from places such as Baghdad, it was made perfectly clear that the military cannot distinguish between communications, which it was then said to me, could come from, for example, the Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard communicating with each other, and from journalists communicating to the outside world. And therefore, it is perfectly possible that these could be, quote, neutralized.
When you say neutralize, you mean?
There has been discussion from a number of sources, military sources, about neutralizing communication systems in order to add to the confusion on the ground and also as an effective weapon of war. If you neutralize the enemy's communication systems and electronic signals, you render the country much more helpless. That is obvious. And there are in development a great number of bits of kit these days which enable the military to do this, because it's a potent weapon of war in order to stop people communicating with each other, that is, in the enemy territory.
In the interview that was transcribed on this particular internet story, you were asked, would the telephone and television signals be fired on? And your reported response was, yes, they would be targeted down.
Targeted down and fired on are two completely different things. To be targeted down, it has been under discussion now for a long time between the military and the media that the uplink signals represent in many ways an obvious element in any battlefield. They can be the military signaling to each other. They could be journalists with allies or with the enemy signaling positions. And there is considerable concern in the military that electronic uplinks are in many ways markers on a battlefield.
I want to go to Rachel Cohen. She's a media analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And how do you respond to what Kate Ady has been saying about the targeting of satellite uplinks?
It's incredibly disturbing. And although I take good note of the distinction she made between disrupting, say, media communications and firing on media, it's a very crucial distinction, obviously. What came to my mind was the incident in November 2001 in Afghanistan when, in fact, Al Jazeera's broadcasting offices were targeted and destroyed by the U.S. military. Another journalist at the BBC, Nick Going, actually did an investigation of this and wrote it up, perhaps because his offices were also in the same building. He found that, in fact, the military admits that it does not distinguish when making, you know, targeting decisions between whether or not the source of the satellite uplink signals are quote-unquote enemy or media. It has in the past led to actual targeting of media, so there's reason for concern about that.
Well, in a telephone interview with Chief Diane Perry from the Department of Defense, the reported comments of independent journalists possibly being targeted by their satellite uplinks in the case of war with Iraq and the reported Pentagon response was, quote, ridiculous. Chief Perry went on to say that there is an inherent risk for journalists in wartime, that journalists could be fired upon accidentally because the military uses the enemy's satellite uplinks as targeting information, She said, quote, if they, the journalists, are independent, are not embedded, and our troops don't know where they are, they could be mistaken as enemy troops, end of quote. Kate Ady, one last question for you. Do you think that the United States government is doing all it can to provide access to the media of what is happening or what will be happening on the ground in order to communicate to Americans back here, of course, to the British public as well, about really what's going on when the war begins?
I'd have thought that's the last thing an American government or a military organization wants. Surprise and secrecy are a weapon of war. And it is a long tradition within the military across the world that they do not deliver the full story instantly. I'd have thought it highly unlikely that there was any desire, particularly regarding Mr. Dick Cheney's attitudes and spoken proven statements on this account, that they would wish to give a full and authoritative access. It will be limited, it will be censored, and it will be controlled. That is always the way. And it has to be recognized as such, and people would be fools if they thought it otherwise.
Rachel Cohen, an analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and war correspondent for the BBC, Kate Ady, speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Incidentally, a Defense Department document on embedding media during possible future operations deployments in the U.S. Central Command describes what the media can and can't do in the battlefield. The document states, quote, media coverage of any future operation will, to a large extent, shape public perception of the national security environment now and in the years ahead. To accomplish this, we will embed media with our units. These embedded media will live, work, and travel as part of the units with which they are embedded to facilitate maximum in-depth coverage of U.S. forces in combat and related operations. Our people in the field need to tell our story. Only commanders can ensure the media get to the story alongside the troops, unquote. Well, while the Bush administration talks of targeting terrorism in Iraq, the war on terrorism may be spreading to peace activists here in the U.S. Tish from the Houston Independent Media Center brings us this critique.
Last Wednesday, KHOU Channel 11's Evening Local News aired a story on their up-close segment called Terrorist Threat May Be Homegrown, in which petroleum engineering consultant Neil Adams declared that in Houston, the biggest terrorist threat to oil facilities is local activists. Which activists? Adams argued anti-war activists.
Neil Adams says he knows all about oil and explosives. An oil well blowout consultant, he says he was among the American crews that helped cap the well sabotaged in 1991 by the Iraqis as they fled Kuwait. And now, back home in the middle of the largest petrochemical complex in America, he argues that pipelines like these may just as likely be targeted by local people who don't like war as by foreign terrorists who don't like America.
Whether the war is about oil or is not, really is not the issue. It's perceived to be about oil, though, and that's the public thinking, and so that's going to make these sorts of sites targets.
KHOU's blatant attempt to paint anti-war activists as terrorists is misleading and serves a purpose of discrediting anti-war activists and breeding suspicion about their organizing and activities. The USA Patriot Act created a new category of criminals, domestic terrorists. Domestic terrorism is defined as activities that appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Most activism falls under this general description. On January 16th, Representative Ray Allen, a Republican from Dallas, introduced a bill to the Texas House which changes the Texas Penal Code to make certain acts of animal and environmental activism into domestic terrorism. Among others, the bill does these things. Defines an animal rights or ecological terrorist organization as two or more persons who support any politically motivated activity intended to obstruct or deter any person from participating in an activity involving animals or natural resources. It makes taking photos or videos of a facility or an employee a felony. It makes supporting groups who do actions like this the same felony. And it creates an internet site with the names, addresses, and photos of persons who have been charged as terrorists. If a group or an individual is successfully labeled as a domestic terrorist, all the sweeping changes to our civil liberties that have been taking place since September 11th become totally legal. Activity like that seen this week on KHOU is spreading rapidly around the country. This week in Minneapolis, Captain Bill Chandler of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department gave a presentation entitled Understanding Terrorism in Minnesota, in which he declared that groups such as Anti-Racist Action, Students Organized Against War, and the collectively run Arise Bookstore and Resource Center were more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. We talked with Mike Whalen of Arise about Captain Chandler's characterizations of the bookstore.
We're a bookstore and resource center that's all volunteer, collectively run, sells progressive books, and provides meeting space for community organizations. And we're proud to align ourselves with groups that champion freedom and self-determination. And we're also against this war that's coming up.
Are you guys a terrorist front organization?
Not at all. We've been around for 10 years. We have tons of support in the community. There's been, since that article, there's been a lot of people calling up and emailing us and actually coming in saying that if we ever needed any help, and how could they possibly say that? And it's really kind of an interesting amount of support that's come out.
You guys had a press conference today. What happened at the press conference?
The press conference was held at the state office building, and it included a couple of the other organizations that were targeted by the police. One was Students Against War, and the other is Anti-Racist Action. We all gave statements, and then there was a amount of time for the media to ask questions. Most of the television stations and some of the radio stations were there, along with reporters from the regular newspapers.
Have you guys experienced any other kind of harassment from the FBI or the police or anything like that?
No, but the FBI has been going to other organizations in town. They went to a student organization for animal rights meeting last week and asked for their mailing list, and then asked for the addresses and names and telephone numbers of people who were there. They naturally refused. They've also gone to other local activists' houses asking for information, asking to talk to them, and they've also refused. So I'm not sure if this is only happening in Minnesota or if it's happening in other places around the country, but people should know not to talk to the FBI.
Do you guys expect to get any kind of retraction from the Star Tribune, the local newspaper that originally printed the story?
Well, that's one thing we're hoping for. I'm sure they're not. All they did was report what happened at the conference. So we try to get retraction from the police department. We're going to ask for files that the police and the sheriff's department have on us as a collective and on the store, and see if there's anything that we could figure out from that. Well, most likely it would be like the Freedom of Information Act file. It would be really hard to figure out things from it, because they black out any informers or give any information that would actually be really helpful. But it's still a good thing to do, keep them on their toes.
Mike Whalen of the Arise Bookstore in Minneapolis, speaking with Tish from the Houston Independent Media Center. Thanks to Renee Feltz from Pacifica Station KPFT for help with that report. As the U.S.-Iraqi conflict continues to unfold, a closer look at a recent history reveals a familiar U.S. policy goal with origins in the Reagan administration: control of the second largest oil reserves in the world. Post-9/11 reverberations have conveniently brought Iraq into the same broad category of terrorism as Al-Qaeda, whose constant transnational presence is the pretext for any war, with or without evidence, with or without international approval. Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed is a British political scientist and director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in Brighton, England, and the author of The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked. Pacifica's Peace Watch spoke with him recently, and he elaborated on the current crisis in Iraq, the Bush administration's possible role in 9/11, and the origins of U.S. strategic interest in Central Asia and the Middle East.
What I found when analyzing the September 11 attacks was essentially that the attacks had been used and exploited by the Bush administration to secure various plans and strategies that had been prepared long before the September 11 attacks. And these plans and strategies seem to have been developed in response to various U.S. corporate interests in basically grabbing control of the world's energy resources. Two particular pieces of evidence that are quite pertinent to this issue of energy, and specifically the issue of the war in Iraq, are two documents which were produced by a think tank based in the United States called the Project for a New American Century, a neoconservative think tank, conducted two very interesting studies, both of which were sponsored by members of the Bush cabinet. And this was about 2 years ago. Both of them essentially provided, and if you look at these documents, they're very explicit and unapologetic in their description of U.S. aims and designs for the world. They go so far as to use the term a Pax Americana. There are many, many countries which are mentioned in these documents, which are named explicitly, including Iraq, with respect to the possibility of a future military intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very interesting because, obviously, I mean, not the current build-up to plans for a war in Iraq has been justified as a part and parcel of this whole new war on terrorism that has proceeded in the aftermath of 9/11. When we find that this whole war was actually quite extensively planned long before the September 11 attacks, then we really start to think that there is something dodgy about the official narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about the one very key quote in the document, it says, with respect to the desire of the United States to get into Iraq, it says that the United States needs to get its troops into the Persian Gulf region, and this need transcends the issue of Saddam Hussein. It specifically discusses the main interest being a strategic issue. So we can see that the idea that Saddam Hussein is the main purpose of the current build-up to war plans on Iraq, the idea that it's all about Saddam posing a threat or not posing a threat with respect to his weapons of mass destruction is really a non-issue. It's a pretext which is being used to justify a design for establishing a military presence in the Persian Gulf region, which
now,
is motivated by strategic interest.
When you say there were two members of the president's cabinet that participated in the writing of these two documents, are you referring to Rumsfeld and Cheney, or who?
Yes, I mean, Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld were sponsors of the study, but they certainly sponsored the study and endorsed its contents. There were other members of the cabinet as well, and also people related to the Bush family. I mean, Jeb Bush, who's the governor of Florida, he was involved in sponsoring
mm-hmm.
the study.
Now, that's a pretty strong statement when you say that there's evidence that the war was actually planned before 9/11. Give us some idea of how you substantiate that, mainly these two documents that you're relying on.
These two documents are a very crucial element of evidence which talks about this general strategy amongst high-level members of the U.S., the current Bush administration, who basically have this desire to get inside the Gulf. It doesn't refer specifically to a very specific strategy or plan, but it refers to the desire of people within the Department of Defense, etc., to get inside the Persian Gulf. And it's very important because it shows that the Persian Gulf is a key region, and this is where they want to be. Now, with respect to the issue of plans existing prior to September 11th, I think it was only shortly after September 11th that we had reports, at least here in the UK, we had reports in the London Times, in the Guardian, and several other newspapers talking about the existence of plans to invade Iraq. It was mentioned in those reports that those plans had been formulated prior to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick Cheney was very eager to push this through, even though he admitted, quite inadvertently, that it doesn't matter whether it's related or unrelated to 9/11, we want to put this in and exploit those attacks to justify what we want to do, which
mm-hmm.
is get into Iraq.
A recent poll by ABC News found that more than half of the Americans believe Saddam Hussein was directly involved in the plot behind 9/11. Is the move by Rumsfeld and others to shift the focus onto Saddam Hussein motivated exclusively by oil profits, or is this opinion closer to the conspiracy theories that Tony Blair denounced earlier this
right.
week?
I think what it is, I mean, the kind of theories that people like Blair are coming out with goes around in circles, contradicts himself, and it's really just something that he throws in for the general public so that they can think, okay, maybe there is a connection to Al-Qaeda and our British government knows about it, but they can't prove it for whatever reason, and that's good enough for us. Again, it's really just a matter of, I guess, manufacturing consent. But I don't think there is no real evidence for it at all that has been produced.
Well, we
by
do.
Anybody.
We have seen apparently some missile heads were located by the weapons inspectors
outside
of Baghdad. And they're saying that these are weapons that Saddam Hussein's administration failed to declare to the United Nations weapons inspector. What's your reaction to that, given all the research that you've done around this issue?
There were technologies which were unaccounted for, like in relation to the odd ballistic missile, in relation to a few certain biological weapons, certain chemical weapons. But on the whole, 90 to 95% of the infrastructure to develop the weapons and the weapons themselves and the products, etc., were destroyed. And one of the key points that is made by people like Scott Ritter, I mean, he's come out and he's basically said that the amount of stuff which is unaccounted for, which we know is unaccounted for, looking at that, it's completely ineffectual. And specifically, he referred to examples of chemicals and biological weapons, which he said there were very small amounts, for example, of sarin gas that were unaccounted for. But he said that these products, they have a lifespan of about two to three years or something like that. And looking at the period between when Saddam Hussein had these stocks, the unaccounted stocks that Saddam Hussein had basically left over, and looking at the time when UNSCOM was present in Iraq, taking up to that time period now, there is no doubt at all that those stocks would have just expired in the last few years. And that's a point that Ritter makes, War Plan Iraq or something like that, I'm not sure. But I read the book, and he kind of summarizes very briefly, in simple terms, quite technical issues with relation to this whole issue of weapons of mass destruction, the infrastructure required to develop the weapons. And he says that infrastructure has been completely dismantled, and the only way that they could actually recreate the infrastructure necessary to create such powerful weapons of mass destruction is if he had tens and millions of dollars being inputted into the country, and that's just not happening. And any such kind of thing happening would be easily detected by intelligence agencies, which are constantly monitoring the country by satellite. And I think the discovery of some unaccounted for missile heads is not really surprising. You know, it's kind of to be expected. There are materials that Iraq has, and which Saddam Hussein is not telling the truth about. I mean, that's to be expected. That's what he is. He's a war criminal and he's a liar. But for us to then conclude, okay, he's got weapons of mass destruction and he's going to be able to blow up the whole Western world in a couple of years is a bit absurd. To then use that to justify an imminent war really is absolutely crazy, to be honest.
Nafez Mossadegh Ahmed is director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in England and the author of The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked. The 1991 Gulf War and the subsequent UN-imposed economic sanctions on Iraq have compelled many Iraqi artists to immigrate to safer havens. Many of them are residing in Jordan, where they hold occasional art exhibitions. Though they're safely away from Iraq now, they say the effects of former wars and the fear of an imminent one have left some blemishes on their work. Ula Farwati reports.
In Amman, Jordan, where many Iraqi artists have sought refuge from consecutive wars and the 12-year-old embargo, art is increasingly speaking a language of politics. Artists say they want to express their rejection to war through colors. Ali Rikabi is a 30-year-old Iraqi artist. 30 pieces of his work are now on display in Amman in an exhibition he titled All the World is Iraq.
The artist is always affected by whatever happens around him. This exhibition is meant to express my loyalty. I reject the foreign interference in all countries and not only Iraq. My six-month-old daughter and wife and friends possess no arms of mass destruction, and I will cast all the blame on the U.S. if something happens to them. Who will compensate their fear and suffering?
Iraqi art is known to be very advanced in the Arab world. It dates back to the eras of the Sumerians and Assyrians, and Baghdad houses the oldest art academy in the Arab world, founded in the early 19th century. Ibrahim Abdali is also an Iraqi artist residing in Amman. He survived the Iraq-Iran War, the Gulf War, and the embargo, but then had to leave to Amman to make ends meet.
The war was hard and difficult. I used to see tragedies, store them in my mind, and go back home to write. The war, however, did not deter me from drawing. I used to work while fire rockets were shattering everything around my house.
Abdali currently teaches art at a private university in Amman. He is afraid that the looming war will destroy Baghdad the way the Mughals destroyed it. When the book's ink discolored the river's water, the Mughals attacked and destroyed the Iraqi capital in the early 13th century. Art critics believe the wars and the sanctions have created a new school within the Iraqi art. The colors have become darker, and the theme in most of the paintings was that of poverty, illness, and suffering. Rikabi says the situation in Iraq has made him carry the plight of his people wherever he goes.
I was born in 1969. I lived through all the wars, and I came to live with this constant fear. I did not live in peace, and I don't know what peace is, because I only hear about war. My life is war and destruction and rockets, and I don't have a single romantic painting that has rainbows, birds, or flowers. All my painting has something to say that danger is around.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati in Amman, Jordan.
First a war on terror, now a war in Iraq. We're reaching a point where we can't turn back. Or let's lose the guns and let's lose the bombs. Or stop the corporate contributions that they're built upon.
Well, I'll be sleeping on these bitches till I start to snore. Cause I won't carry guns for an oil war. A salam, ooh, a lick em, ooh, a lick em, salam. Peace to the Middle East, peace to Islam.
Now don't get us wrong, cause we love America. But that's no reason to get hysterica.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our assistant producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.